It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's suburban communities have been less reliable for Republicans in recent elections. A longtime political observer takes us on a tour of suburban areas around the state. First, a new book puts Native Americans at the center of the history of the United States. But that hasn't always been the way that story has been told. Growing up, I could think of three ways Native American cultures were usually treated in school and pop culture. One, they were ignored. Settlers just sort of moved into an empty wilderness. Two, they were treated as an obstacle to U.S. expansion. Three, more sympathetically, they were treated as victims of American expansion. In his new book, our guest reexamines that history by incorporating the stories of indigenous communities as active participants in that history and focusing on the interrelationships between Native peoples and European settlers and their descendants. He says you can't really understand American history without those stories. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about U.S. history and its indigenous cultures? What do you want to know about Native people's history here in Wisconsin? In a bit, we're going to look at some more recent chapters in Wisconsin history. Do you have an experience to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ned Blackhawk is the author of the new book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. He's Western Shoshone and a professor of history at American Studies at Yale University. He was on the faculty at UW-Madison from 1999 to 2009. Ned, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to quote here from your introduction. Here it goes. American history developed out of the epic encounter between Indians and European empires and out of the struggles for sovereignty between Native peoples and the United States. American Indians were central to every century of U.S. historical development. That, I think, Ned, sums up a lot of what you're trying to accomplish in this big book. Can you talk a little more about that recentering of our history?
I'm happy to. The new book attempts to provide a single volume interpretive overview of Native American history and does so, as you indicated, by looking at every century of American historical development and formation. And each chapter and the two halves of the book are attempt to ground Native peoples, their power, their agency, their resiliency, and their struggles for survival at the heart of the American historical experience.
And I want to talk about some examples in earlier American history. One case you make is that we can't really fully understand the development of the U.S. Constitution without looking at the interaction between this fledgling nation and the Native American communities that it was encountering. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Chapter 6 concludes the first half of the volume, and it's about the formation of the U.S. Constitution, the place of Native Americans within it. And as you suggest, it makes an argument, as do the other chapters, that these kind of quintessentially paradigmatic moments of American, in this case, political and legal history, are indelibly imprinted by the presence of Native Americans and the larger context of Native American history. You likely have learned at some point that the first government in the United States wasn't very successful. It's the Articles of Confederation, which governed the Continental Congress during the Revolutionary Struggle. Was a disempowered kind of national political community or governing structure. I think I write somewhat playfully that the Articles of Confederation constricted more than they confederated. And it lacked the power that the eventual federalist system would develop through the constitutional government. The myriad ways that Native peoples shaped the formation of the Constitution are evident in the text itself. And so we could turn to the Commerce Clause. We could turn to the representational proportionment portions, and later to the 14th Amendment itself, all of which mention Native peoples or Indians. Indians are mentioned three times in the Constitution. And that inclusion reflects the centrality of Native peoples to the evolving concerns of the founders. And so one of the few areas of consensus that emerged out of the early deliberations within the Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia was that there was a need, a dire, critical need for a stronger national government capable of handling interior, diplomatic, military, and political relations with Indians. So the Commerce Clause has these kind of five, you know, extremely important words that lodge the authority, that all the states cede the authority to the federal government to conduct commerce between the states and with foreign nations and with the Indian tribes are the five words. And that's just one example. The Constitution also upholds the existing treaties, both made and to be made by the United States government, to be the supreme law of the land. And so treaties become, as you know in Wisconsin, central elements of the kind of evolving doctrine of federal Indian law and policy that are struggled for and upheld and often reinterpreted throughout the territorial and state histories of many Midwestern states, Wisconsin included.
Talking to Ned Blackhawk about his new book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ned, I'm going to fast forward past a bunch of history to one of the chapters I got to admit I knew the least about, and it had a really important role to play here in Wisconsin. In 1950s, an effort to terminate the existence, the status of tribes in country or in tribes around the United States. I want to start with a listen to Ada Deer of the Menominee here in Wisconsin talking about that Termination Act, speaking here in 1976.
Termination was a disaster, politically, economically, culturally. Our roles were closed, and this has a very drastic effect on Indian people. I remember one old Indian man in our traditional village of Zor telling me that one day he was an Indian and the next day he was not.
Ned, take us to the 1950s and this move in the federal government to toward termination, toward ending the status of many tribes around the country.
You know, I want to thank you for including that that segment there. I hadn't heard it before and look forward to learning more about it. You may not know that Ada was the director of the American Indian Studies Program at Madison when I was working there, and we worked, you know, together for many years. And she's recently released a beautiful autobiography that relays a lot of this history. It's published with the University of Nebraska Press, and it highlights this kind of dramatic turn in federal Indian policy that occurred in the aftermath of the Second World War and during the early years of the Cold War era. As she suggests in your segment, this was a disaster. This was like one of the worst kind of potential political decisions the federal government has ever made regarding Native American communities, at least in the 20th century. It was an attempt to essentially abrogate those treaty relationships I referenced earlier, to return essentially tribal communities over to states, where the Menominee, for example, her tribe became a county within the state of Wisconsin, and essentially to remove what was often called federal supervision. More legally, we would call it the federal trust doctrine, where the federal government holds reservation lands in trust and operates in partnership with tribal governments, the maintenance and welfare of the lands, resources, and communities upon them. So in the early 1950s, in 1953, the Congress passed a concurrent resolution known as House Concurrent Resolution 108 that legally terminated the political distinctiveness of Native nations. And each tribe, there were about 100 that got terminated, including the Menominee, who were able to delay the process a little bit into the early 60s. Each tribe essentially lost its standing as a reservation community. So what happens to tribal members? Well, the federal government's also going to subsidize their one-way migration or urbanization into urban centers through a program notoriously or infamously known as relocation. So these are the two national policies of the federal government in the early years of the Cold War, termination, relocation. These are assimilative efforts to disaggregate the jurisdictional autonomy and the sovereign authority of tribal communities, to assimilate their individuals into the body politic of the United States by sending particularly young families and individuals away from tribes to urban environments, and to erode a doctrine of federal Indian law and policy that dates back, you know, essentially to the founding, that had created bilateral treaty relationships between hundreds of tribes and the federal government, and also importantly, financial and other kind of federal commitments and healthcare, housing, education, and other kind of components. And so the Menominee, as you may know, have a longstanding sustainable timber industry that's one of the most kind of respected in North America. And it was heavily undercut and threatened by this kind of really challenging and difficult policy that came into being and lasted until the early 70s, when Ada, you know, very, very heroically and others led an effort to get their tribal sovereignty restored in the Restoration Act of 1973. So Ada's in the book. There's a nice image of her overseeing the Secretary of Interior as he's signing these Restoration Acts. There's a lot of that history that's conveyed, and I wouldn't obviously have really been able to understand it the way I try to without those years of experience back in Wisconsin.
Talking to Ned Blackhawk, author of the book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. He's a professor of history and American studies at Yale University. Before that, he was on the faculty at UW-Madison, looking at the history of the United States and Wisconsin from the perspective of Native peoples, indigenous communities, and how they interacted with the U.S. government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that we focus enough on Native American history and its role in the wider story of the United States? If you're Native American yourself, are you seeing more of these stories getting told, more of this history being taken seriously in your own community and beyond? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Ned Blackhawk from Yale University. He's authored the new book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. His book explores the importance of Native peoples and indigenous cultures to the United States and Wisconsin up to the present day. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jonah is with us in Menominee. Jonah, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Jonah?
So I had a question about the Caribbean, the indigenous peoples in the Caribbean. So when European folks came over and colonized those areas, as well as the mainland, throughout their history, have any of the Caribbean nations that still have been controlled by the U.S. over all this time, like the U.S. Virgin Isles, for example, have any of them identified as Native Americans? Where geographically are the cultural lines drawn?
Jonah, thanks for the call. Ned, you focus, I think, on mostly mainland United States here. Do you have thoughts for Jonah on Native cultures beyond the U.S. borders, or in, as Jonah says, in U.S. territories in the Caribbean?
That's correct. It is mainly a history of a continental history of North America, or at least the contiguous United States. Chapter one does explore the kind of initial phases of Spanish settlement and colonization in the Caribbean, and sketches some of the incredibly destructive impacts that early phases of Spanish colonial rule, exploitation, enslavement, and disease introduction had on the indigenous populations. These are some of the darkest chapters in the history of the Western Hemisphere and include the wholesale slaughter and often extermination of dozens of indigenous communities. Native Americans in those regions did survive. Many became incorporated into labor regimes, into various religiously organized mission communities and other forms of Spanish settlement society. And that survival has imprinted itself on numerous distinct, or there's been a distinct imprint of that survival within a series of Caribbean nations. In Puerto Rico, for example, the Taino communities retreated into many of the highland regions of the island and forestalled Spanish conquest for generations and indeed even centuries. It's also true in
places of Hispaniola and other kind of more mountainous Spanish colonial regions. So it'd be helpful to understand the kind of distinct imperial regimes or nation states that eventually, or empires that eventually controlled these islands, because many were heavily exploited and turned into plantation societies, particularly among the English and French kind of colonial holdings across the Caribbean. But it's a really interesting kind of comparative lens to think about this history more broadly.
Thanks for that call, Jonah, at 800-642-1234. Ned, I want to look at another portion of the book now. And again, history I wasn't familiar with. Some of the first violence in the U.S. at the outbreak of the Civil War was actually militias in the West targeting Native American communities there. Can you share some of that history with us?
I can. And I appreciate that kind of opportunity to do so, because, again, like with the Constitution, there's a big chapter, or at least an ambitious one in my own mind, on the origins of the Revolution in the volume. And there's a chapter on the Civil War that opens in the West and tries to lodge indigenous history at, if not the center of the conflict itself, as one of its kind of central legacies. Mm-hmm. Because the conflict between the Union and the Confederacy is inarguably the crucible of American history. And most American history classes are, you know, divided in half or begin before or after the Civil War era. At least the survey classes of American U.S. history offered often in universities and colleges, like at UW-Madison, where we have, I think it was History 101 and History 102. Mm-hmm. And even AP history classes in the country often are up to and before the Civil War. So there is just an incredibly vast, not just literature of scholarship on the subject, but an incredibly kind of set of developed understandings and paradigms for understanding this era. And they've kind of overwhelmingly failed to not just understand the tens of thousands of indigenous lives that were also lost during these crucial years, but also the legacies of the war itself. Because that's one of the major themes of that chapter and of the next chapter. Because the federal government during the war develops a capacity to do things that it had never been able to do. And so there's a series of examples, case studies, and even kind of anecdotes that kind of highlight this. One of my favorites is that when Lincoln was campaigning in 1860 and gave this famous speech in Cooper Union, New York, it took him 4 days and I think 5 different trains to make it to New York City from Springfield. And each train he traveled had a different size gauge, so that there was no kind of regionally united or national railway system. By the end of the war, and this is the opening scene of a few famous books on the subject, Lincoln, after his assassination, is carried slowly by train throughout most major northern and midwestern urban centers, and his coffin is draped and shrouded in black, and also travels at 5 miles an hour across a newly constituted railway system. So that image really just stayed with me as a kind of representational kind of frame for thinking about the dramatic transformations that the war unleashes. One of which is obviously militarily. There are roughly 20,000 Union soldiers in 1860. Nearly a million will serve on behalf of the Union itself, including, I think, approximately 180,000 African-American soldiers. Just to give this is a nearly exponentially larger military force. So the federal government is increasingly generating what we would think of now as the modern American administrative state during these years. And it's establishing federal funding and subsidies for not just national militaries, but state organized militias as well. And so there's been a series, or there were a series of campaigns already in existence throughout California during the long period of the California Gold Rush, in which white settler communities and their militias increasingly targeted and destroyed particularly mountainous and Northern California Indian communities. And once the war begins, then they start appealing for state and then later federal funding to do so. So I make a suggestion that these are, in fact, the first casualties of the Civil War, Indians killed by state militias using federally funded resources to enforce a new kind of property and political and kind of racial regime that will ultimately lead to, as is widely recognized in the field, the genocide of tens of thousands of California Indians.
Ned, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Ned Blackhawk. Ned was a UW-Madison faculty member for 10 years. Now he's a professor of history and American studies at Yale University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. He joined us today to share a history that centers around the experiences of indigenous peoples and how they helped to shape the Wisconsin and the country that we know today. Coming up after the news, suburban voters in Wisconsin have trended away from rock-solid support for the Republican Party in recent elections. We'll talk to a longtime state political analyst about how those changes are shaping statewide results and what's happening in suburban communities around Milwaukee, in Dane County, in western Wisconsin, and around Green Bay. And you can give us a report from your own community. Have you seen big political changes? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at big changes in American religion in the last couple decades and why those trends could shape American elections in 2024. Now, election analysis in Wisconsin often focuses on the rural-urban divide in the state, where voters in the bigger cities tend to vote Democratic, voters in the smaller towns tend to vote Republican. But in between, there's another key group that has shifted their support in recent elections and shaped the results in statewide races. Our next guest analyzed data on suburban voting in Wisconsin. And the big trend is that voters in the areas around the state's biggest cities have leaned more toward Democrats in recent elections than they did in the past. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen your own community's voting results shift in recent elections? Has your county or city or town leaned more Republican or Democratic than you expected? Why do you think suburban areas in Wisconsin have moved generally toward Democrats? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Craig Gilbert is a Lubar Center Fellow at Marquette University Law School. Before that, he was the longtime Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He wrote a recent analysis in the Journal Sentinel called What 30 Years of Voting History Tells Us About Wisconsin's Shifting Suburban Vote. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you.
Now, when we think suburban vote in Wisconsin, sometimes we think, okay, we're talking about the Milwaukee suburbs. In your piece, you talk about that, but also suburbs around the state. Can you give us a taste of where you had your eyes on?
Yeah, so a big theme of the analysis I did is just how politically diverse and geographically diverse the suburban vote is in Wisconsin. So, you know, obviously Milwaukee's the biggest metropolitan area in the state, but even within metropolitan Milwaukee, you've got very different kind of suburban communities, politically speaking. You have, you know, the WOW counties, which are the Republican-leaning counties on the periphery of Milwaukee County, Ozaukee, Washington, and Waukesha, and they're diverging politically from each other. You've got the inner suburbs on the north side of Milwaukee County, which have become very blue. You've got the inner suburbs on the south side of Milwaukee County, which are more purple. you've got the suburbs of Madison, which is basically the rest of Dane County minus the city of Madison, which have gone from being purple over 30 years to being very, very blue. You've got the suburbs of the Green Bay Appleton area in the Fox Valley, which have been Republican leaning historically, but maybe getting a little bit less so and fairly competitive. And then you've got, you know, the sort of smallest area I looked at was on the far western side of the state, which are sort of the exurbs of the Minnesota's Twin Cities. So we're talking about the western side of St. Pierce, of St. Croix and Pierce counties, which are very purple and not very big.
But one big trend, which however we slice it, whatever the starting point was in those different suburbs you just laid out there, Craig, all of them, if I have this right, are trending away from Republicans and toward Democrats.
Virtually all of them. Now, some of them are not changing very much at all, but others are changing quite dramatically. And so that includes, you know, purple and blue suburbs getting bluer, like Milwaukee's North Shore and like the Madison suburbs, but it also includes red suburbs getting a lot less red, like Ozaukee County, the county to the north of Milwaukee County, which, you know, when I started covering politics in Wisconsin in the late 80s and in the 90s, was reliably the most Republican county of the 72 Wisconsin counties. And now there's about 44 counties more Republican than Ozaukee. And that's because Ozaukee's gotten a lot more purple and a lot of rural counties have gotten a lot redder. So you've got, you know, the interesting thing about the last 7 or 8 years, which I sort of think of as the Trump era, is before that, you had these suburban areas kind of going in wildly different directions. You know, red counties getting redder, blue counties getting bluer. And now they're all kind of, they're very far apart in some cases, but they're all kind of moving in the same direction, which is they're becoming collectively more favorable to the Democratic Party.
Before we start digging deeper into political areas, Craig, let's talk about why this matters. There's a lot of votes at stake in that list of counties you just outlined, right?
Yeah. Now, the suburban vote, you know, in some states is like the entire vote. I mean, I think New Jersey would be a classic example of that. And in other states, it's very small. And Wisconsin is kind of in between. I mean, I think it's about a third, 30 to 40% of the vote, depending on how you define, you know, the suburbs. There is no like single definition of what is a suburb. And there's no like single government definition of what is designated a suburb. But in Wisconsin, you know, if you look at polling, if you look at, you know, the way I've mapped this, it's at least 30% of the statewide vote. So it's a lot of votes. And it also includes, like we've talked about, some areas that, because they are shifting, are having a pretty dramatic effect on statewide elections, because you're seeing a swing, you know, in some cases, when you add it all up, of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 votes over, you know, one or two or three election cycles in a state as close as Wisconsin, that can tip the outcome.
Talking to Craig Gilbert about a piece he wrote in the Journal Sentinel called What 30 Years of Voting History Tells Us About Wisconsin's Shifting Suburban Vote. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for Craig about what's been happening over the last 20, 30 years? Do you have ideas about what might be leading suburban parts of Wisconsin to almost as a whole move toward Democrats over that time period? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Craig, let's dive into the wow counties, the counties around Milwaukee County. These were, I could have said it in my sleep, you know, Republicans to win statewide elections have to run up big turnout in those counties because they're going to win them by a ton. What are we seeing happening there over the last couple few elections?
Yeah, so historically, these are among the highest turnout places in America. And historically, they delivered, you know, sort of more effectively for Republican candidates than almost any other counties in America when you combine their turnout and the fact that they voted by landslide proportions for Republicans, particularly at the top of the ticket. So we've seen, you know, the most conservative, now the most conservative of the wow counties, which is Washington County, kind of, you know, hang in there for Republicans. It's, you know, they won it by almost 40 points in the last race for governor. But then, you know, I've mentioned Ozaukee County, which has really moved more away from the Republican Party than any other county in Wisconsin. And then Waukesha County, which is really important because it's big. It's really big. And it has gotten less Republican. It's still pretty red, but it's not nearly as red as it used to be. And these trends, you know, really sharpened, I would say, in the last 6 to 8 years. The last big election, November election, where the WOW counties performed like we used to think of the WOW counties, was the 2014 election for governor, which was won by Scott Walker.
And it's a really key point you're making, Craig. This doesn't mean that Democrats are suddenly, you know, winning majorities in any of those three counties. It's just that Republicans are winning by much less than they used to. And in a statewide election, like you say, that's enough to make a difference.
Yeah. In fact, there's still lots of Republican suburbs or lots of Republican voters in the suburbs. If you added up all the areas that I looked at, which is about a third of the state's electorate, you know, it's still very evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats. It's just that it used to be a distinct Republican advantage, and that advantage has kind of vanished over the last decade.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think the guest kind of hit the nail on the head. What I was going to say is that it seems relatively recent. I mean, Scott Walker dominated, as the guest stated, in 2014, and things have changed. The two big things appear to be Donald Trump and abortion. And it seems to be a lot of Republicans may have held their nose and voted for Republicans when they didn't agree with their stance on abortion. But now that the law has changed, it's pretty obvious that women want to kill their babies. So as a result, things are shifting.
Steve, thanks for the call. Craig, Steve saying abortion and Trump may be the answer to the question why this change is happening.
Well, abortion and Trump are part of the answer. And again, I think the answer is going to be a little different depending on what part of the state we're looking at. For example, I mentioned, you know, how the suburbs of Madison are a lot bluer than they used to be. But that process started 30 years ago and has been very steady. Whereas if you look at the North Shore in Milwaukee County, you know, they were still pretty purple 15 years ago. And then they started shifting. And then when you look at Ozaukee County and Waukesha County, yes, that began to happen in the, quote, Trump era. So there are some big structural trends and forces at work here. So, you know, you can't put it all on Trump. You can't put it all on abortion, even though those are obviously in play in a big way in recent election cycles. But, you know, one interesting thing about the WOW counties is that, you know, long after similar counties in outside of other northern cities were starting to get less Republican and more Democratic, the WOW counties, for one reason or another, were continuing to get more Republican. So they were kind of defying a national trend, at least in northern metropolitan areas. And so now they're kind of, you know, they're following that trend. And so even though abortion and Donald Trump are factors, they're also kind of following some pretty big national trend lines when it comes to, you know, more densely populated communities, higher education communities. These are sort of structural forces too.
Let's go now to Jordan in Holman. Jordan, hi. Jordan, are you there?
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Jordan. You're on the air.
Okay, perfect. I just wanted to echo what the other caller said about abortion. Also, I know our abortion law dates back to the 1870s, which is extremely outdated. And also, young voters being able to vote, I think that we underestimate how much more Democratic leaning, especially my age group is. I'm 18 years old. And especially like in Madison is super progressive. I think Milwaukee is very much pushing that way, and the places around it are really kind of feeding off of that. Young voters, especially being called to go out to the polls and vote, especially young women regarding abortion who want to stay in Wisconsin, have reproductive rights.
Jordan, thanks a lot for the call. Craig, we've talked about youth voting on the show since our state Supreme Court election saw a pretty substantial younger voter turnout. Your thoughts on how that may weigh on all of this?
Well, I think these are things to really look at going forward. I don't think they explain everything looking back, because again, you know, the Dobbs decision is fairly recent on abortion, and some of these trends we've been talking about, you know, absolutely predate, you know, the Dobbs decision, and they go back to 2016, 2018, et cetera. So, but I think going forward, it's going to be really interesting. It was interesting, certainly in this last state Supreme Court race, played a big role, and it and played a role in the previous November election. So it's going to be really interesting to watch and see what kind of role it plays, you know, next November. And some of that is going to depend, obviously, on what, you know, what politicians do and what the parties do and what is done legislatively and what is done by the new liberal majority on the state Supreme Court. That is also going to shape the role that abortion plays in these elections.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Craig Gilbert about shifting voting trends in suburbs around Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Craig about geographical voting trends here in Wisconsin? What are you seeing in your own community? Are you in one of the suburban areas we've been talking about so far? What are you seeing in your neighborhood? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Craig Gilbert from the Lubar Center at Marquette University Law School, longtime writer for the Journal Sentinel, looking at his analysis of how suburban voting trends in Wisconsin have changed over the last bunch of elections. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Craig, let's check in on suburban Dane County. Now, people see big Democratic vote totals in Dane County. They might think, ah, yeah, sure, Madison. But as you write in your piece, Tommy Thompson won suburban Dane County, I think you said, three times. Something has changed.
Yeah, a lot has changed. And so and one thing that's changed is the growth. I mean, it's not just the fact that a lot of communities that used to be purple and maybe even red-leaning, I mean, if you go back far enough in time outside of Madison, have gotten increasingly blue, but all the growth, and the growth means that the suburbs of Madison, the rest of Dane County, is, you know, just as important as the city of Madison. And more importantly, that's where, you know, the shifts have occurred. So the more suburban part of Dane County has just had a profound impact on statewide elections. It's a big reason why Dane County is just kind of this, you know, big blue monster, in the sense that, you know, the Democratic margins just get bigger election cycle after election cycle, which is, you know, hugely beneficial to Democrats in statewide elections, because it means the Republicans have to sort of make up, if their deficits are growing in raw numbers in Dane County, and Dane County is a very big place, Republicans have to kind of make up that difference somewhere else. So the suburban Dane County trends have been really significant.
Let's go back to our callers. Sean is with us in Stanley. Sean, hi.
Hi. I guess in that regard, the Republicans have been pushing, and I know gerrymandering can go both ways, but with the gerrymandering that's taken place over the last 10 years, how has that played in to the, if more Democrats are voting or more people are voting Democrat, does it make a difference because of the gerrymandering?
Sean, thanks for the call. Craig, your piece focuses on the statewide elections where those gerrymander lines don't matter. But take us into those state legislative votes, even without gerrymandering, the way Democratic voters are packed into places like Dane County gives Republicans a bit of an edge. Take us through that.
Yeah, and they, even with the shifts in the suburban vote, you know, it tends to be in the more densely populated suburbs where Democrats have made the biggest gains. So you can still, you know, draw a very gerrymandered map, even with the Democratic growth in the suburbs. I mean, one thing we've seen in the Milwaukee area is, you know, the same state Senate district that, you know, two maps ago straddled, you know, the North Shore of Milwaukee and maybe a little bit of the Wow counties, then, you know, one map ago got moved further west to keep it Republican. And then in the current map got moved even further west further from the city of Milwaukee in order to maintain a Republican majority. So it's obviously had an effect on how the maps are drawn. But it doesn't, you know, by itself, it doesn't affect the ability of one party, in this case, the Republican Party, to draw a very gerrymandered map. And as a result, the fact that the suburban shifts have made statewide elections more challenging for Republicans in the Trump era hasn't affected legislative elections in that sense.
Thanks for that call. Well, Craig, we've covered the suburbs around the state's biggest city and second biggest city. Let's go to the third biggest city. You looked at the area around Green Bay. What do we see happening there?
Yeah, so I looked at just a collection of about a dozen communities in three different counties, Outagamie County, Brown County, and Winnebago County, pretty suburban communities. And these have pretty consistently been, you know, 10 or 15 points more Republican than the state as a whole. That hasn't changed dramatically, although the Republican advantage has gotten a little smaller in recent elections. So that's a place to keep an eye on. Again, the challenge for Republicans is going to be to try to hold the line in some of these communities where they've had a lot of historic strength, but have seen that strength, you know, ebb in recent elections. The change is not dramatic in these, you know, northeastern Green Bay, Appleton suburbs, but you've seen some signs of it in recent elections. They are overall, you know, kind of more purple than the Milwaukee County suburbs and the Dane County suburbs. But there's still a place where Republicans have historically had an advantage.
And let's go to the western part of the state now. You mentioned the exurbs of the Twin Cities that have branched out into part of our state. What did you find there? These are smaller counties, for one thing, than most of the other ones we've been talking about.
Yeah, and they're different because they're further away. In this case, they're in the orbit of the Twin Cities in Minnesota. So they're in this suburban or exurban periphery, across a state line, and they're really exurbs more than suburbs. And so, it's kind of a mix of people that are, you know, that are actually like maybe commuting or working for companies based in Minnesota, and then maybe some more just sort of traditional Wisconsin communities. Back in the 90s, they actually leaned a little Democratic, but as these suburbs began to grow, as a lot of suburbs, you know, as suburbs have grown around the Twin Cities, they got sort of more Republican and more conservative, but now they're shifted back a little bit in the other direction. So they're very, very purple and very competitive. They don't have a big impact on statewide elections, but if they keep growing, they'll have an increasing impact on state elections.
We've got, of course, elections coming up in 2024, Craig. Now, we can't, past performance is no indicator of future performance, as the investment people say. But what are you watching for in these suburban voting trends next year?
Yeah, so I think the big, question is whether these trends, post-2014 trends, which have made the suburbs more favorable for Democrats, continue, or whether Republicans can kind of like stop the bleeding. Because if they can't stop the bleeding, it just makes the math a lot harder statewide. I mean, in this period of time, the last 6 to 8 years, we've seen Republicans win a few very narrow elections for president in 2016, Ron Johnson's Senate race this last time, one very close state Supreme Court race. But their ceiling has been just over 50% of the vote, no margin for error. And that's because they've lost numbers in the more populated parts of Wisconsin. So I think it's going to be really important for Republicans, again, in statewide elections, in top of the ticket statewide elections, to try to stem the losses, to kind of slow the erosion or stop the erosion in these suburban areas, because, you know, if they lose another, you know, net 10 or 20,000 votes in Waukesha County, and they continue to lose the Dane County suburbs by bigger margins year after year, and we've seen what's happened in the inner suburbs of Milwaukee, you know, again, you have to find those votes somewhere else. And the question is, even though Republicans have made massive inroads in rural Wisconsin, that's not the part of the state that's growing. And, you know,
we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Craig Gilbert. Talk about a piece he wrote for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I've never been to Yellowstone National Park. I'd like to someday. A lot of great sights to see there. But now here's a new way to experience it from a distance. Not the sights, but the sounds. And not sounds you can actually hear when you're there. As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, there's a new musical rendition, we're hearing it now, of the seismic activity at Yellowstone. Evidently, there's a lot going on underground because Yellowstone's really seismically active. You wouldn't really notice that just standing there. A scientist and a musician teamed up to take those seismic vibrations and translate them into music on a flute. One tricky thing, the seismic vibrations are nonstop, but a flute player got to breathe from time to time. I say let's turn it into an awesome techno beat instead. If I do go to Yellowstone, I'll probably try not to think about all the plate tectonics going on under me. This is Central Time.